It's the Debatable.
Hello and welcome. You are listening to It's Debatable on Campus FM. The frequency is 103.7. I thank you for tuning in to our radio show. I am Darren Katkuti, your host for the next half hour. For the past 10 weeks, Hilary Briffa and I have had second year international relations students present in our studios, and together we have discussed a wide range of topics which have dominated the international agenda. However, today's episode of It's Debatable will focus on a special interview with Professor Hazel Smith. Hazel Smith is Professor of Resilience and Security, and she is also Director of the Resilience Center at Cranfield University. She has written various publications about security and North Korea. One of them includes Hungry for Peace, International Security, Humanitarian Assistance and Social Change in North Korea. Professor Smith, I welcome you to It's Debatable.
Thank you for having me here.
And we shall be speaking with Professor Smith about the issue of East Asian security. My panel for today also includes second-year international relations students Luca Lacetignola and second-year law with international relations student Elizabeth Malia. I welcome you both to It's Debatable.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On today's show of It's Debatable, we shall be exploring the importance of maintaining security in East Asia and the role which the region plays within the international community. Professor Smith, I would like to start with you first. Why exactly did you decide to focus on North Korea in particular with regards to its relationship with the region?
My first major piece of work on almost any issue in academically was a study of the Central American Revolution, the Nicaraguan Revolution, way back in the 1980s. And conceptually, I maintained an interest in the relationship of revolutions and the international system. From the Jacobins onwards, from the French Revolution, probably from before, revolutionary states, small, often poor revolutionary states, have had a major impact on the international system beyond what one would expect given the size and scale of their economies and their populations. So my first work was on Nicaragua and the international system, revolutionary Nicaragua, and I had the accidental opportunity to visit North Korea in the late 1980s. I eventually first went in 1990. Mm-hmm. I found I knew nothing about this country, and so I started to research it. It was as simple as that.
Do you think it's an advantage that you first visited North Korea before you commenced with your academic studies?
I think that if you are an academic professionally, then you have a training in analysis. And at that time, I was starting a PhD, so I was starting my training. And so if you are going to organise yourself professionally, you ought to be able to think analytically about the society that you're in and also allow your observational skills to inform your more book-based research. So if you're fortunate and if you've got some sort of training, the relationship between what you observe and what you study in libraries should be fruitful and productive. And I think I was fortunate enough that I was at the stage of my academic career where I had some space to develop a new topic, which I'm still working on over 20 years later. And I'm afraid it was only by accident, not really by serious design, that I became involved in North Korea. Although intellectually I was interested in the relationship of revolutions in the international system. And of course, North Korea, although it's a relatively small state, maybe not compared to Malta, but compared to a lot of states, 23 million people, and it's certainly a very poor state today, has had an enormous impact on the international relations of East Asia and international relations globally, at least over the past 20 to 25 years, and also for periods during the Cold War. So that sort of dynamic, that research question, still motivated why I retained an interest in North Korea during this period.
Thank you, Professor Smith. One of our panel members for today, Elizabeth Malia, is particularly interested in this antagonistic view of North Korea, right?
Yes. I was wondering, where does this image of North Korea come from, this warlike nuclear North Korea? Who's projecting it?
Well, I think that there is historical credibility to the image of North Korea as being aggressive. North Korea was created as a state at the end of the Second World War. Was formalized as a state when South Korea was formalized as a state in 1948. Korea, as a country, North and South, had been one country for, well, the Koreans trace their history about 5,000 years. So this was felt to be, by both sides, North and South Korea, a very, very artificial division. 1948, the two states were created because the United States and the Soviet Union, more or less, had agreed to a separation under two separate ideological systems. But from 1948, when those two states were created out of what had been a long historical unity, both sides, North and South Korea, the leaderships undertook to reunify Korea. And both North and South Korea originally decided that, if necessary, that they would use military force. So both North and South Korea were determined to reunify the two now divided Korea using force if necessary. In 1950, North Korea invaded the South to try to achieve that aim, although I think it's fair to say that South Korea would also have been seeking the opportunity, if it could at the time, to reunify by any means possible. With the end of the Korean War, though, in 1953, North Korea remained for quite some time, one of its objectives remained to unify the peninsula, if necessary, using force. There's some debate as to when North Korea decided that force might not be its preferred instrument, but it's from that period that we can see North Korea's image as being belligerent, aggressive, and it's in relationship to the potential reunification of the Korean Peninsula. If we fast forward 30 or 40 years to the end of the Cold War, because North Korea was protected more or less politically by the Soviet Union during that period, from when Russia became democratic at the end of the 1980s, then North Korea began to feel extremely vulnerable in the 1990s and in the early 2000s, because it felt, and it was probably true, that the former Soviet Union, now Russia, and also China, may not come to its aid if there was some form of hot conflict. And it's from that period we see particularly the acceleration of North Korean attempts to develop a nuclear deterrent. It's also from that period that we see economic collapse in North Korea. North Korean government realizes it can no longer depend upon its army, which, although vast, is demoralized and doesn't have much economic support. And so it's from this period that we start to see the development of a nuclear program. And again, it's this more recent period, I think, which shapes the international image, some of which is based in reality, of North Korean strategic intentions. In East Asia, but of course, if you have nuclear weapons, that these strategic intentions would have an impact throughout the rest of the world.
Luca La Cetagnola is also interested in this humanitarian and food deficit, which exists in North Korea, and how the government is trying to overcome it. Right?
Yes, we know that in effect, food and money are the major problem in North Korea at the moment. And in spite of the different suggestions that there come from the United Nations or other countries to help the economic development of North Korea, basically these countries still reject the suggestions given. But which measure can be practically adopted by the North Korean government in order to overcome this humanitarian and food deficit?
It's a very good question. The North Koreans was subsidized indirectly more than directly up until the late 1980s by the former Soviet Union, by East European countries. Not so much by China, because at that time China was still a relatively poor country. It was subsidized in the sense that it received cheap fuel, and it also received preferential access to its markets for its goods. So North Korea could survive. It grew, not economically, not as much as it wanted to do, but it was able more or less to feed its people, to develop a higher education system, to develop an education system, to develop a health system. With the end of the Soviet Union and the move to liberal capitalism in former communist states, all those subsidies of every sort ended to North Korea. Now, North Korea is not a subsistence economy. It did have a very large industrial sector, and its agriculture is very dependent upon industrial inputs. What that means is that it needs fuel, fertilizer, chemicals to have agricultural production. It also needs to have an export industry so it can sell its exports and then buy food for its people. When the 1990s came, it had no decent exports that anybody wanted to buy. It had no major sources of export earnings once its manufacturing industry collapsed, which it did so. And it could then no longer buy inputs for fertilizers in its chemical factories so that it could produce food for its people. In a very, very short order, that resulted in famine, in which nearly 1 million people died in the early 1990s. In that period, the United Nations humanitarian agencies came into the country in quite a big way. The World Food Programme, which I used to work for, and UNICEF, which I also worked for. And they provided massive humanitarian aid. But of course, humanitarian aid is really basic aid. It's basic food. And it doesn't help in redevelopment of the country. And because of the overall political situation between North Korea and the United States, Japan, and the major countries of the West, North Korea could not access major development aid money, that's World Bank money, which it would have needed to redevelop the country. So since the 1990s, North Korea has been stuck in this economic limbo where it receives humanitarian aid to keep going. Although there is severe malnutrition in North Korea, it's not a famine situation, although it teeters on it on some occasions, but it does not receive development aid in order to get the economy going. What has the government done? Well, apart from trying to solicit humanitarian aid, it has, over the last 5 or 6 years, since 2002, legalised the market economy which has developed from below. And what I mean by that is when the state could no longer provide food and income, and it was the major provider of jobs and income until the 1990s, although nearly 1 million people died in North Korea from famine, 23 million people survived. And they survived by creating their own market economy from below without the sanction of the government. That has continued now for over 20 years. The government at various times has tried to roll back this development. It doesn't like the fact that it can't control this market economy. But from the 2002 onwards, it decided it is not in the foreseeable future going to be able to replace go back to the old system, and so its view now is that it must try to control the market economy, which started from below. Now, this has led to all sorts of ambivalence, because at the same time as people are creating their own economic opportunities, the government is trying to take surplus food income off them in order to pay the army, feed the army, etc. And at the same time, the government hasn't embraced the liberal capitalist economy. It wants to be able to politically control the people in a much stronger way than, say, China controls its people right now. And it feels that if it allows more openness politically, which it would need to get the economy accelerating, then this will mean the end of the regime, because the regime does not have much legitimacy anymore.
Because normally this government rejects officially the help of other countries, do you think that at this point NGOs can play an important role for the humanitarian assistance?
Well, for the past 20 years, the government has been soliciting help from other countries and from NGOs, including from its adversaries. The United States, for instance, has been a donor of aid to North Korea. Japan has been a donor of aid to North Korea. So what the government wants to do is to solicit aid and technological support from other countries. For instance, the government at the moment, the North Korean government for the last several years, has been trying to send its educated workforce, or some of its educated workforce, to Western education institutions. It's got people studying in the United States. There's an exchange relationship between Syracuse University in the United States, between Stanford University in the United States, and some of the educational institutions in North Korea. When I was at the University of Warwick, which I was until 2 years ago, I ran a four-year exchange program with North Korean policy analysts. So we have seen a change of mood in North Korea, that the government does want to have foreign assistance, but it can't get enough of it. And because we are talking about big input of funds that would be needed to shift the economy in a modern direction to create manufacturing industry, for instance, this would require World Bank type funding, and that would require a political decision by the United States to allow North Korea to have World Bank funding, and that isn't likely to happen until the nuclear issue is resolved. So they will continue to receive, NGOs operate in North Korea right now, American and European NGOs, they will continue to receive small level support from NGOs, humanitarian support from some of the United Nations agencies and some governments, but the major sorts of funding they would need for economic development is not likely to materialise without a political solution to the nuclear standoff which is taking place right now, where North Korea has developed a nuclear programme and where the rest of the world is saying that this is not a development that that the rest of the world welcomes, as vis-a-vis the United Nations resolutions that have been passed on this issue.
Right. I thank you, Professor Hazel Smith, and my two other guests for today, Luca Lachutoniola and Elizabeth Malia. Certainly, you raised a lot of relevant points with regards to North Korea and security in the region itself. Unfortunately, we have to stop for a short break, but right after the break, we have more questions for our special guest today, Professor Hazel Smith. I invite our audience again to join our conversation with questions and comments by sending an email on info@mrsa.org.mt or as by logging on our online forum on mrsa.org.mt. I invite you all to stay tuned. I welcome you back. You are listening to It's Debatable on Campus FM. The frequency is 103.7. I am Darren Katkuti, your host for today. Today we have a special episode, and our special guest for today is Professor Hazel Smith, who is interested in resilience and security, especially with regards to North Korea. My two other guests for today are second-year international relations students Luca Lachutoniola and law second-year student Elizabeth Malia. Before the break, we were discussing the role of civil society and the role which NGOs play in Northern Korea. Liz over here is also interested in the relation which North Korea has developed with its neighbours. Perhaps you can elaborate more on this aspect.
Yes, now my question was whether North Korea can work with its neighbours, because it has to do that due to the ever-increasing state of globalisation we see. And can it successfully cooperate with them despite all the regional rivalries, territorial conflicts and ideological differences? And how vital is this ability to North Korea's security?
Well, I think that is a very, very important issue. And maybe the best way to think about it is to divide the government, the North Korean government, from the North Korean people, and to look at the different dynamics that take place at those two different levels. The government works closely with China, the Chinese and the Russian governments, two of its neighbours. And at times, since 2000, it's had intermittently reasonable diplomatic relations with South Korea. At the moment, those relations are not very close, but they have had since 2000 intermittently decent relationships with the South. Japan, North Korea, the North Korean government has had its worst relationships with, although, as I mentioned earlier, even during the hostile political relations that have characterized the dynamics between them, Japan has given them food aid, quite substantial food aid, when they were coming out of the famine period in the 1990s and as late as 2000. So relationships do exist between all the neighbors, but certainly the closest that North Korea has are with the Chinese government. They're not always harmonious, even with North Korea's allies, and China is the major one, because China does not approve of North Korea's activities, including having nuclear tests. But nevertheless, they are relationships of conflict between allies rather than adversaries. So in those political relationships between governments, the dynamics are such that there can be political discussions over areas of conflict. And of course, that's the first step, really, in resolving conflict, having the channels available to communicate. there has been, for the last 6 or 7 years, maybe more, a multilateral organisation called the Six Party Talks, where Japan, Russia, South Korea, North Korea, the United States and China have periodically got together to try to discuss the major strategic issues of conflict that lie between those various states. At the moment, the six-party talks are in abeyance, but it may be likely that they'll come back together again. There are also bilateral opportunities for negotiation between the two governments. South Korea and North Korea, for instance, although they're adversaries, have regular meetings between their militaries to discuss conflicts between them. At the level of society, different groups within the society, that's a more complex issue, because depending upon the different group within North Korean society depends the contact that you have with outside your borders. For example, if you live near the North Korean border with China, if you're a North Korean, you're quite a long way from Pyongyang, so that means that you have less surveillance from Pyongyang, which, because the government simply can't afford any more fuel and to send off officials up on a 3 days journey up to the border. Yet this is a very populated area, the North Korean border area with China, and there is a lot of opportunity for North Koreans living in that area to move into China, to do a little bit of work, to engage in whatever trade they can do, and then to come back into North Korea. And in this sense, the globalization that we understand between societies, where there's exchange of ideas, where people watch each other's DVDs and listen to each other's pop music and engage in effectively social interaction across borders, takes place in a very intense way, and certainly in a way which did not used to take place up until, say, 15, 20 years ago. So already North Korea, in parts, irrespective of what the government wants, is not able to close the door to globalization. And this, I think, means that if there is a political change in the government, such as to allow the sorts of openness which I think probably most North Koreans would like to see, never mind people outside North Korea, then we have seen built over the past 15 years a base for social interaction between North Koreans and the rest of the world, particularly through China. I mean, China's a developed state now, and it's Chinese traders that are keeping the North Korean economy going. So we do have a base there underneath the government of interaction with the rest of the world, which we didn't have 15 to 20 years ago.
So, Professor, is it right to argue that this perception that North Korean society has a siege mentality in with regards to its beliefs that the rest of the international community wishes them harm is actually changing, and it is not the case right now?
Again, I think we have to think about the government and the society. The government certainly thinks that the United States would like to overturn the regime, and not just the United States, other governments, and would like to see another sort of government in North Korea. In a sense, that's not untrue. That other governments have made that clear. The reaction by the North Korean government, though, is perhaps what's at issue. It has responded to what it sees as a threat of possible invasion by not wishing or not having the trust that it can negotiate with its adversaries in order to end the overall conflict, whether it's on the nuclear issue or whether it's on the ideological issues that divide North Korea from other countries. And in this sense, it has further developed what you might call a siege mentality. It does consider that every opening that is made to it is fraught with dangers. And that will probably continue until the regime can convince itself, if it ever can, that it can have some sort of economic opening without endangering the political survival of the regime. Personally, I don't know if it's possible to square that circle, and I don't think that the government in North Korea considers it's possible to do so either. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have the confidence, for instance, that the Chinese government has, that it can have massive economic development, allow foreign investment to come in, and still maintain political control of the society. It doesn't have the confidence because it doesn't believe anymore that the people overall consider that the government is legitimate. After all, most people have been suffering malnutrition for nearly 20 20 years. They've seen an absence of freedom in the society for nearly 20 years, and they blame the government. But at the level of the society, it depends where you live. If you live near the South Korean border, which is heavily militarized, and you only have access to North Korean government officials in terms of channeling an outside view of the world, you may come to believe that North Korea is right in everything it does, the government is right in everything it does, and that you are besieged simply because you are an independent nation, which is one version of the politics which North Korea gives its people. However, if you're one of the several million people that live near the border with China, and even if you're not, if you come across Chinese traders in your day-to-day existence, and you're likely to do that, you are not really going to be exempt from the information about the outside world which your family used to be 20 years ago. You will be aware that South Korea is a prosperous country, South Korea, that China is now a prosperous country. And this may ask you, this may encourage you to ask why you're not prosperous, why North Korea isn't prosperous. And although some people will undoubtedly think it's all because of the foreigners who are imposing their will on us, some people will think, after all this time where they've been suffering poverty, now nearly 20 years, well, perhaps we should have a change of government. So I think at the level of the society, there's a whole lot, as in every society, there's a whole lot of different views about the government and about the outside world. But what we can say now, compared to 20 years ago, is there is much more knowledge of the outside world than there ever used to be, unmediated through the government.
Perhaps society has become more complex as well.
North Korea has been, since its inception in the 1940s, an industrial society. It's not a subsistence, and never has been, a subsistence agrarian society. Mm. It's had a very, many people don't realise, has a numerate and literate society from top to bottom. It had 11 years free compulsory education. It had a huge tertiary education system, colleges and universities. And it had a hugely complex society. So I think North Korean society was a complex society in terms of its organisational matrix. But the difference perhaps between the North Korea of 20, 30 years ago and the North Korea of today is that the government had an effective filtering mechanism in order to select what information could come through to its people. And now that filtering mechanism simply doesn't really work. It doesn't work.
Certainly these were very important points which we mentioned regarding North Korea. I thank you all for joining us, especially Professor Hazel Smith, and I also thank my other two guests for today, Elizabeth Mallia and Luca Lacetagnola. It's Debatable is a conjoint initiative between the Department of International Relations within the University of Malta and the Malta International Relations Student Association. I, Darren Katkuti, would like to thank you, our dear listeners, for joining us today, and I invite you to join us next week, and we shall be discussing migration with Justine McAuliffe and Nicole Sherry. Thank you for listening.
It's Debatable.